Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Jean Purcell. Coming up later in the hour, you've probably heard of the STEM subjects. Well, our guest says the arts should be added to that initiative.
Now, though, Wisconsin State Representative Melissa Sargent of Madison has proposed a bill that would legalize marijuana for medicinal and recreational uses in Wisconsin.
Selling pot for recreational use was recently legalized at the state level in Colorado and Washington, but it remains illegal on a federal level. Many states have taken other steps in recent years to decriminalize cannabis or to legalize it for medical purposes.
Here with us to talk about her proposal for marijuana in Wisconsin is Representative Sargent. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So, looking at the response so far to your bill, the gist seems to be that it has little hope of passing in the GOP-controlled legislature. Do you think it has a chance?
We're late in this legislative session. This is something that I've been working on. I don't take this issue lightly. However, I don't believe that we'll be getting a public hearing or seeing this move to the floor during this session. I do believe it's a conversation that needs to be had, and I am proud to be bringing it forward for that purpose. It's a matter only of time before this happens. It's not a matter of if we're going to have legalization in Wisconsin.
So let's talk about that. Proponents of different pieces of legislation over the years have often used inevitability as part of their argument. In this case, you know, we're saying no matter what we do, marijuana is likely to become wholly legal in the United States. Do you think that's a reasonable argument to use?
I do. There is more and more polling that people are paying attention to and doing that showing that there is a changing of tides. And it's legal for people to smoke cigarettes. It's legal for people to drink alcohol. And more medical studies are showing that, in fact, marijuana usage is far less damaging to the body than either of those substances.
So what do you see as the strongest argument for legalizing marijuana in Wisconsin?
Well, personally, there's a few that pull at me the most. One of them is the racial disparities in marijuana arrests in our community. African Americans are 4 times more likely to be arrested than Caucasians, despite very similar usage rates. This is egregious. Our criminal justice system is overtaxed. This is a nonviolent offense, and it's costing us money, us valuable taxpayer dollars that we could be spending in many other ways. And there's also the civil liberties issue. Should government be involved in regulating what it is that we can do that's not hurting ourselves and not hurting our community?
So far, Wisconsin hasn't decriminalized cannabis or legalized medical marijuana. Why is this bill aiming for full legalization right out of the gate?
Well, I fully support Representative Chris Taylor and Senator Jan Upperbach and their hard work with the Jackie Rickert medical marijuana bill. And I believe that a conversation needs to be had looking at everything on the table. So what I'm doing is adding another card and look forward to having those communications. One of my concerns is, personally, I feel that we offer loopholes with medical legalization, and I would just assume see it happen at a full legalization level.
Do you see this as something that could become a partisan issue?
Well, I think that I can tell you it's going to be a partisan issue because, you know, Republicans say straight out, you know, this is something that those hippie liberals from Dane County care about and other folks don't. But I have received more calls today than I can count. I'm sure my staff have kept a tally of them, but countless, probably half of them, have been people saying, you know, I'm a Republican, and I believe that government is too big and they should be out of my business, and I fully support what you're doing, and I think that this should be a values issue and not a party issue, and I couldn't agree with them more.
There's also an economic issue. Looking at some numbers today, Colorado has already taken in millions of dollars on the back of legalizing marijuana. Is there an economic argument to be made, do you think?
We can't turn our backs on the economic arguments. Not only would we be saving money, very valuable taxpayer money, on decreasing arrests and prosecutions and jail time and prison time through the criminal justice system, but we would also add revenue as well as that money saved. Colorado is projecting a $10 billion annual revenue by the year 2018, and there is a huge market in job creation. I've talked to many businesses today that have called my office that are involved in fabrication of equipment that's used to grow marijuana, and it's creating jobs. This is something that we in Wisconsin desperately need. So absolutely, there are economic benefits. And one of the guys that called me today said, oh, you're just another tax and spend liberal looking for another tax. Well, I'm not going to say I'm not, but that absolutely was not my impetus for moving forward here.
Now, you said you think this is really going to end up being more of a conversation starter than a piece of legislation that has legs. But looking at the specifics of what you proposed, what are they? Are there restrictions involved? Who gets to sell marijuana?
Yeah, there are restrictions involved. The marijuana would be sold through shops, and the growers would be licensed. There are restrictions on how much each person can purchase at a time, and there are restrictions to how much folks can store in their homes. I tried to be very pragmatic about coming forward with this bill. And again, I look forward to talking with folks that have thoughts on how we can make it a better bill. But we absolutely do need to have this conversation going.
Now, I assume you've taken a look at Colorado and Washington. Is there a model there that could apply here?
I did look especially at Colorado because they seem to be a little bit farther along in the process, and did take some of the language and thought processes from them.
And what would that be?
As far as permitting and distributing of marijuana and some other factors as well.
In terms of health concerns, are there things that you think, you know, maybe we still need to be cautious about moving forward on this?
We have a drinking age in Wisconsin that's 21. I put a provision on this bill of an age 21 for possession. There are some, that's an example of an area that I was cautious, as well as, you know, some people are concerned about driving under the influence of marijuana, and we do address that in the bill as well. I had some other folks that brought to me the concerns of people going out and buying and bringing a lot to their homes and storing it. And we did end up putting it at a half an ounce per purchase for in-state residents. But each adult in the house can have that half an ounce. So if you have, you know, a couple living together, you could have a full ounce of marijuana.
So for the sake of argument, let's say you're right and it is inevitable. What kind of conversations would we then have to have with our children who, you know, we've been telling drugs are bad, stay away from drugs? I mean, we're not in the era of just say no anymore, but this is something that has been illegal in this country for many years.
Well, I am the mother of four sons. Two of them are teenagers, and two of them are much younger than that. And we have to have these conversations with our kids. But right now we're creating a culture where it's a taboo conversation. And we can talk to them about drinking. We can talk to them about cigarettes. I believe that if marijuana is legalized, that we're going to be able to talk more eloquently and educated with our children about the usage of it.
Representative Sargent, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with State Representative Melissa Sargent. She's proposed legalizing marijuana for medical and recreational use in Wisconsin. If you'd like to weigh in on the issue, you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We hear a lot these days about how the STEM fields, that's science, technology, engineering, and math, are the future of education.
But our next guest says STEM is missing something, namely art and design, and by adding those subjects to STEM, it could create a new movement to transform the 21st century economy and solve some of the world's biggest problems.
We're joined now by Babette Alina, Director of Government Relations at the Rhode Island School of Design, that is home of the STEM to STEAM movement. Babette, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to start out with a background on STEM, and I'm trying to think back, what, maybe 4, 5, 6 years, something like that, when the whole idea of STEM, this idea of learning about science and technology and engineering and math, really started to take off. Why was that?
Well, there were two main reasons. It was initially to engage students into a research workforce, essentially. So where does innovation come from? A lot of it comes from research and development and discovery. And the makeup of the population as we look to the future is more and more of an immigrant population. A lot of the populations that are currently underserved will be much less in the minority. And agencies like the National Science Foundation, we're looking at how do you develop that kind of human capital? How do we engage students in workforce and careers that will benefit them and the economy? And so it was really an access and engagement strategy initially for a particular kind of workforce.
And there was a feeling at the time that that kind of training, that kind of, you know, training in science and what it is and how it ties in with technology, that it really wasn't readily available and that there needed to be a special focus.
Absolutely.
Now, as we've been down that road now for, like I say, 5, 6, 7 years, I'm not sure how long the STEM movement's been around, why all of a sudden a realization that we need to stick that A in there? Is this something that we've come from over the last couple of years, the experience that there's been something missing, or was it missing all along and we just didn't realize it?
I think that it's been missing all along, and many people did realize it. One thing that we're noticing over the last few years is that by putting, I'd say, a brand on it, by calling it STEAM, it's something that people can come around. It provides an umbrella for a kind of thinking that has really never ceased to exist. We often talk about this unnatural bifurcation of the disciplines and how the arts and sciences have, you know, sort of naturally been together in much of our history, and then only recently, you know, say in the last maybe 50 to 100 years, have they sort of split apart. And people often point to the very obvious example of Leonardo da Vinci, scientist, artist. A lot of the way that artists and scientists work are similar. A lot of it, especially early on, relied on observation. You know, if you think of naturalists, nature actually democratized how people had access to scientific information. And then I won't pretend to know the theory of why they separated, but what we're seeing is that we're growing a sort of a national movement around the idea of STEAM very rapidly because it has existed at the grassroots level under many names for a long time.
And so what might some of those names be that people might have heard?
Just very commonly, art-science collaboration is one of them. I believe MIT is the source of the publication. There was a publication called Leonardo that I believe is still in existence that documents this kind of collaborative work. There are federal agencies like NASA that provide artisan residency programs. The National Science Foundation has made investments over time that are, you know, how do we improve education or how do you innovate STEM is one example of where we see it. It's really STEAM could be an answer to that, but it's not called out as such.
And I just want to clarify, are we talking K-12 education here, or is this beyond that?
Well, at RISD, we're interested in it in sort of three areas. One is in education, and for us, because we're a higher ed, it's K-20. But the focus is certainly, in terms of grassroots, the focus is certainly on K-12. At RISD, we're also very interested, and this is also, we've seen this in pockets all over the country, interested in how artists and designers collaborate with any of the STEM, so-called STEM disciplines, on research and discovery. So what does it look like if art is not necessarily in service to science and science is not necessarily in service to art as, you know, just a subject matter? What happens when you put the mind of a scientist and an artist together to co-problem solve?
So what does happen?
Well, we're finding that I'll give you a good example. We met with a program officer at the National Science Foundation early on when we were advocating for STEAM or attention for this. And we learned that we were sort of singing to the choir. They said, we work with artists and designers all the time. The difficulty is, in terms of peer review, the credit is difficult if they don't hold a PhD. So there are certain gateways in terms of recognition for certain peer review publications. So this particular scientist shared that he had been working in an area where they had produced a massive amount of data, and they were trying to parse through it and try to visualize exactly what they had found or whether they had found anything. And he had a colleague, I think it was a personal relationship, it was an artist, a fine artist, who came in on the team and literally saw what the other scientists were missing. And the discovery was really a result of that collaboration of an artist just looking at something visually and seeing something different. And the story he told me was that, unfortunately, when the results were published in a peer review publication, the artist was not credited as a PI because they didn't hold the credentials.
And here you've got an example of an outside person coming in, an artist coming into the scientific setting. But it sounds like what we're trying to do is take those various people and put them together, put that training together, so that one person has those skills to come to that same conclusion by themselves.
Right, and we're not advocating that people should know everything. Certainly, there's a benefit to having depth in your area, but it's also, we're seeing that it's beneficial to be able to speak some of the language of your collaborators. So the idea of, I think it's been spoken of as the T-shaped person. Unfortunately, I'm not sure who to credit for that, but it's definitely not me. The idea being that you have depth in one area and you have some breadth in multiple areas, which makes it sort of ideal for collaboration. So you have a scientist with depth in whatever their research focus is, and you have an artist coming in with whatever their interests are. And then together, because of their distinct expertise, they're able to come up with something different. There's also a lot of belief about sort of innovation and research happening at the periphery where disciplines intersect. So irregardless of whether we're advocating for art and science specifically, typically if you work at this sort of edge, new ideas are generated, and they have some evidence of that. And then I wanted to go back to your earlier question that the other thing that we're very interested in where we're seeing this play out, the idea of STEAM, is in terms of encouraging employers to hire artists and designers in settings where you might not imagine them working. And RISD has actually secured funding to put our students in policy settings or NGOs over the summer. This is our second round. It's funded by the Maharam family. And they have worked in places like the Mayo Clinic and were brought in to, say, solve this particular problem. They came in and say, actually, that isn't your problem. Let me talk about this other thing that I'm noticing. And ended up solving something that really was, you know, the issue, but wasn't what was presented to them.
And I have to ask, from a practical standpoint, when you're going into a place like, say, the Mayo Clinic, and you've got somebody from the outside with this artistic viewpoint, how is that received? I mean, do you get some pushback?
There's a little suspicion. For this particular program, it's entirely student-driven, so they have to develop a relationship with the host, and they develop the project together with the host. So this particular student approached the Mayo Clinic, I believe through a RISD connection, developed a project, understood what she was walking in to solve, and then, so she was accepted. They knew they were taking in a design student at that point. And then in terms of how receptive they were to her solution, they were incredibly receptive and ran with it, and I believe offered her a job.
Let's talk a little bit about what STEAM might look like in the classroom. And, you know, in Wisconsin, as I imagine around the rest of the country, there's a big discussion right now in K-12 circles primarily on Common Core standards, for example. How does something like STEAM fit in with a paradigm like that? Is it possible to do?
I love that question. So I've learned recently, because I do not have depth in K-12 education, but I'm skimming the surface, that there are core standards for art education. Unfortunately, in a lot of school districts, you know, as you know, arts and sports are the first things to get cut, so there's not a lot of investment.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what district you're in and in what region and in what state and so on and so forth. But there are standards for art education, as there are standards for math and reading and so on and so forth. So what we're seeing is that art teachers and, say, a math teacher are interested in this idea because ultimately they just want to get students interested in education. And with that goal in mind, teachers are really innovative people. Think about, you know, the kind of person that chooses that profession. And we're seeing that they're finding each other and saying, how can we deliver what you need to deliver as an art teacher? So, you know, color theory, shape, understandings of geometry. And how do we take that and combine it with what we need to deliver, say, in geometry, and put something together that's maybe project-based or experiential or happens outside of the classroom or what have you, so that you're developing competencies, student competencies, in areas with depth, but you're also allowing this place to play.
So we've only got a minute left before the next break, and I want to talk about money a little bit, although I hate to do it.
That's okay.
You know, we're talking about putting something different into a curriculum at a time when there seems to be no money for this, whether you're talking K-12, universities are being stretched. How do you convince people that this is something worth spending money on? And we're going to have to keep it short, and we'll pick it up after the news.
Well, I would love to pick up that topic. I can say that it requires a very minimal investment. If you're working off what exists in core standards, the curriculum is prescribed to a certain extent. What teachers are calling for that are interested in promoting STEAM or practicing STEAM is to just have the planning time to work with their colleagues. And very often we're seeing that effective programs are when they have a dedicated person to actually coordinate the teachers from multiple disciplines.
Okay, let's hold it right there, but we will pick it up after the news and talk about that funding aspect. We're talking with Babette Alina about turning STEM into STEAM, and we'd like to hear from you. Do you see a value in incorporating art and design into the fields of science, technology, math, and engineering? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the intersection of art and science and education with Babette Alina this hour, and you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. How do you think art and design should be a part of science, technology, engineering, and math? And if you're a scientist or an artist, how do you see the value in the other's work? Give us a call. We've got some open lines for you at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Babette Alina, before the break, we were talking about that sticky issue of money, and it was a big question. You didn't have time to answer it all, but you were talking and starting out the idea of people taking the time to be able to plan things out and have that ability to kind of look at the bigger picture.
Yes, and I would also like to add to that, so we get a lot of teachers calling us and asking, you know, how can I do this, or do you have a curriculum in a bottle, or who is in my region that's doing this, what are the best practices, and we do a lot here to facilitate those kinds of interactions, but I'm hearing that it's time, it requires you to have an art teacher in your school, so that's a financial consideration. Some schools that don't have that ability will reach out into their community. So a lot of them have relationships with, say, a local arts organization where they can bring people in. They've sustained those relationships over time, and I've learned that they are very happy with them. It's not quite the same thing as having a dedicated person in your school, but people are doing what they can. So I think the first consideration is, you know, does the school district have sufficient funds to pay for the artist or designer to create STEAM? And then assuming that they do, or once they do, then the investment is fairly minimal. It's, you know, supplies, if it's a learning module that happens outside of the classroom, it's, you know, the bus to take them to the museum or to the aquarium. It's the supplies that they use in the classroom. It's the planning time for the teachers. And I can't put a dollar amount on that, but I know that it's significant. And the programs that are developing the fastest also have sort of a head teacher or an administrator that coordinates and supports the effort.
Let me ask you, we do have some calls. We're going to get to those in a second. In this day and age, though, there are all sorts of efforts at reforming or changing or modifying educational curriculum and methods and so forth. How does STEAM fit within that, and is it getting lost in some of that noise?
Interestingly, it's not getting lost. We're seeing more and more examples just from the outreach to, say, you know, RISD or my office alone. It's happening all over the country in every way you can imagine. And interestingly, it's almost exclusively at the teacher level. So there's a real authenticity to the movement because it's people who have experience with engaging students and understanding what engages students, and they are grabbing onto this and holding on and figuring out ways to do it. And they're all different, as I said, different flavors. So one example, and I will promote this because it's a RISD alum, but there's something called the Institute of Play and Mission Lab in Manhattan. It's a public school. And what they do is they use games and the idea of play to engage students in STEM. And they're very successful. So that's one example. There's a series of schools called A-plus schools. You may have heard of them. They're around since, I think, 1998. So that's been around for quite a while. They fully buy into the idea of STEAM, but they don't call it that. So they have a very unique curriculum they've developed, and they have four schools that follow that model. There are a lot of schools that are using technology to sort of follow the idea of STEAM. So there are schools called High Tech High. They're in California. I think there are five of them now, where they're just using technologies to engage students. It's similar to the Institute of Play. And going back to your funding question, that's another thing that the schools are asking for. They really view technology as the bridge, and they need more of it. They want more of it.
Let's go to the phones right now. By the way, if you would like to join in and give us your two cents on the intersection of art as it relates to science, technology, engineering, and math, we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How is this being incorporated into curriculums in Wisconsin, perhaps, either in the K-12 schools or university level, technical college level? Let's go to Greg now, and Greg is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Well, hi. I think art is one of the most important subjects there is in school. I've taken biochemistry, clinical lab, health, physics, all sorts of things. Now, I'm an HVAC. I'm 60, and I'm still in school at MATC. But I believe that art, how do you express yourself? If you come up with an idea, how do you express yourself if you don't have any art? I mean, if you don't know how to put your ideas down on a piece of paper, you have to take communication skills, English and things like that, but you also have to take art because art is such a big part of communication. If you can't show your idea, how can you go anywhere? You're stuck. So that's just my idea, and that's all. I'll take my comments, your comments off the air, okay?
Greg, thanks so much for the call. And what do you think about that idea that expressing yourself, even in someone in a scientific field, is a key part of how art can help make you into, I guess, more of a better rounded engineer. Babette?
Oh, it's a question to me. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I have a very short answer to that. We have a dual degree program between RISD and Brown University that started in the engineering school at Brown and the industrial design program at RISD, and that's now spread across the institutions. And one thing we've learned is engineers need to know how to draw.
Just for the simple fact that they're thinking about ideas, things they need to build, whatever, or design something, and the simple fact is that you can't necessarily do that on a computer or express it in some other way.
Exactly. And you can eventually do most of it on a computer, but we're finding, at least with RISD and Brown students, and I should speak mostly for RISD students, that understanding of working with the materials, it gives you a different insight. It's a tactile experience. It's a more direct connection between brain and process than going through the technology, which is different than what I was saying about technology being the bridge between the disciplines. That's
right.
A different idea.
Interesting. Let's go to Madison right now, and Diane joins us. Hi, Diane.
Hi, good afternoon to the two of you. I love STEAM, and I'll tell you why. Because to me, it overrides a binary opposition between left and right, between scientific and artistic. And I think it works with how the human brain works and probably relates to most of human history, not history in the literary sense, but in the evolutionary sense. What do you think of that?
That's a great question. Babette, what do you think about that?
Well, that's a slightly more complicated answer than the last one I gave, but I am currently working as an artist with a neuroscientist who has explained to me that it's just not that simple. So we have been approaching this as right brain, left brain, and there's a wonderful program that I'll also call out in Oregon called the Right Brain Initiative, and they work with a local elementary school on STEAM curriculum, and they are also very successful at this. Evidently, it is not just as simple as left brain, right brain. There's a lot of stuff in between, and one is not necessarily delegated to one hemisphere of the brain or another. So that is my rudimentary understanding of the physiology of the brain. But in terms of how do you put the two, you know, strengths together, that is the whole premise. I fully agree with you, Diane. It is the premise of the STEAM movement to be able to say these disciplines are stronger together than apart.
In about a minute and a half that we've got remaining, we've been focusing a lot on sort of the K-12 aspect of things, but what about a student who winds up in a technical college or a university setting and they haven't had this sort of background? How do you fit that in to the curriculum at that point? Is it too late for them, or is there still a way to make it happen?
Well, a lot of the work that happens in technical schools is work with the hands, if you think about it. You know, think about shop, which gives a real understanding of material. So it's not, those students are probably closer to understanding the principles of art and design than most other students that aren't in technical school, because they're having to deal with those things. So if they're not actually drawing to understand some of the things they're learning, they are definitely fitting things together.
And what about the idea of lifelong learning? You're out of school and you still want to pick some of this up. Is it, you know, you're a craftsperson and you could pick some of it up, I sort of think, by osmosis, but are there other ways that you could do it?
We have a very strong continuing education program at RISD, and not just to promote ours. There are wonderful continuing education programs all over the country, and there are also a lot of sort of higher ed programs that are developing. I'm aware of two at Harvard. I think they've just developed a PhD program or a master's in education program. It's a one-year program. So for someone like me to go back to school and say, you know, I really would like some depth on education, I think you can do that. You can do it somewhat in an art and design school, although I have to say that it's so hands-on that it really does take the time. So continuing education programs are a great outlet. But not to answer your question directly, but it brings up a point that I'd really like to make, which is that art and design teach critical making. So in other words, this understanding of, you know, how things are put together and how things are made. And it also teaches critical thinking, because you have to be able to imagine. And what we're finding is that those skills are transferable, meaning so if you're looking at not necessarily workers that are having to retrain, but the future workforce, we are dealing with jobs that will change so rapidly we can't even imagine what our children will be doing 20 years from now.
And Babette, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much.
These skills transfer. So thank you so much.
You bet. Babette Alina is the Director of Government Relations at the Rhode Island School of Design, home of the STEM to STEAM movement.
Here's a look at what's making news in Wisconsin with our Assistant News Director, Noah Ofshinsky.
Hey, Noah.
Hey, Gene.
Well, we have a lot of state news to get to this week, and, you know, one of the high points, everybody on Wednesday night was watching the State of the State address from Governor Walker. And what was this, his fourth one, his third one?
Yeah. Well, this one, I would say, is crucial for the governor, because if you watched it, you probably realized and had – if you had watched previous speeches, you'd realize that this one was long. This mm-hmm. one was the longest speech that he's given, State of the State. And you would also probably would have gotten the impression that maybe he was running for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was very much the tone that he was going for with the speech, both here in the state and, you know, I'm just throwing this out there, maybe a potential run for the White House. But anyway, he laid out his plan for the state and basically said, look, the economy is improving here in Wisconsin. The jobs picture is improving. And he laid out some pretty big initiatives that he would like to make happen here in the coming months.
You know, and in the past, his State of the State addresses have always been about looking forward and about some of the challenges facing the state. This time around, he had some really good news to share in the form of a $1 billion surplus to the state budget.
Right. This was money that they did not expect necessarily that was going to come in, but because of the improving economy, increased tax receipts, that sort of thing, the state is looking at something like $1 billion surplus. And in his speech, the governor laid out what he would like to do with at least some of that money. $100 million he would like to put toward an income tax cut for folks here in Wisconsin. He'd also like to use about $400 million of that surplus for property tax relief as well.
So that's $500 million there, and
yeah.
That all sounds good.
Yeah.
But we keep hearing about this structural deficit in the state. It was here when Governor Walker took office, and there are those that say it is still here.
Right. As of right now, we're talking about a deficit of something like around $725 million. And when we talk about a structural deficit, what we really mean is the difference between how much cash the state has at the beginning of a budget cycle and how much money they've already committed to spending. And that structural deficit is something that I think the state Senate would like to spend some of that surplus money on. They would like to put that money in a rainy day fund, pay down that structural deficit. The Assembly, generally speaking, tends to be more pro-tax relief. So, you know, they look at these tax plans. They love it, the GOP majority. The GOP majority in the Senate, however, would like to use some of that money to really fix that structural deficit that's been with the state for a while.
And yet we haven't talked about everything the governor wants to do, because he does also want to spend some money on technical colleges.
Right. We're talking about something in the neighborhood of $35 million. He wants to eliminate waiting lists in high-demand fields like manufacturing, agriculture, computers, that sort of thing. He wants to help high school students get training in those high-demand jobs through things like dual enrollment programs. And he'd also like to spend more money on programs that help the disabled enter the workforce as well. So some of that money will also be going towards the technical colleges and the disabled.
So we've heard a little bit about what other Republicans think of the governor's proposals. What are Democrats saying?
Well, let's go to probably the biggest Democrat in this whole thing, which is Governor Walker's possible opponent at this point.
I would
point.
Say likely. But...
likely. Hey, I'll let you said it, not me.
Mm-hmm.
Possible opponent. But right now, the only opponent, Mary Burke, a former Trek executive who is running on the Democratic ticket. And, she said that she would like a greater proportion of that surplus we're talking about. That should be spent on the structural deficit, as well as putting money in the rainy day fund. Although it should be said that they are on the same page, Mary Burke and the governor, when it comes to tax relief for those in the lower tax brackets. They both agree that some of that surplus money should be used for tax relief. But obviously, Mary Burke is of the mind that, again, like some of the senators in the state Senate have said, you know, they'd like to see a greater majority of that money or a greater part of that money go towards the structural deficit.
So I think the governor has proposed a special session already, right, on this?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, I think we'll be seeing action on any number of these initiatives here, at least by legislative standards, very quickly.
And given the way everything is structured right now, the likelihood is that what the governor proposes is very close to probably what will happen?
Absolutely. I mean, given that the Republicans control both the Assembly and the Senate, and everybody agrees that tax relief is a good thing, I think you'll see money put towards paying down the structural deficit. I think you'll see some of that surplus being spent as on the rainy day fund. So I think this thing is going to, I don't want to say sail through, but pretty darn close.
Elsewhere, the Natural Resources Board met, and we'll be talking about some of the findings of the deer czar in just a few minutes. But they talked about some other things, too, including the bear hunt.
Right. So one of the things they tackled this week was the bear hunt. And basically what they did was they voted to increase the quota by about 17%. This year, that means around 4,700 animals can be harvested by hunters.
Interesting. And forgive me for not knowing the answer to this, but how controversial has the bear hunt been?
Well, it is obviously controversial. There are folks who feel like that, you know, we shouldn't be hunting bears.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are a very passionate group of bear hunters, as well as people who support a bear hunt for any number of reasons. You know, the increase, the 17% increase we're talking about, is at least in part to help, according to the DNR, to shrink a population of bears, particularly in northwest Wisconsin, that seem to be getting into trouble, you know, eating crops and getting into cabins and that sort of thing. They're, you know, considered to be nuisance bears. And that's one of the reasons why we're looking at an increase in the quota.
Elsewhere, something I think a lot of people would like to hunt is the emerald ash borer. And we are hearing news about that all over the state. And the board thinks they can do something.
Right. So over the course of the last few years, the radius in which people can bring firewood mm-hmm. into public lands has slowly been
state
shrinking.
State park or whatever.
State
yeah.
park, exactly. State forest lands. And that circle is continuing to shrink. This week, they voted to shrink it from the current 25-mile radius to 10 miles. So again, that circle is getting smaller. It also should be said, though, that the board also voted to allow wood in from outside the state. For instance, you know, Illinois. I mean, there are state lands
right next
to each other, basically, certainly within that 10-mile radius. And they voted to allow that firewood. I mean, currently, they can't bring in firewood from outside the state. So,
well, we will see where that goes. But I'll tell you, that is a story that we're going to be hearing a lot more about in future years. And then finally, something we heard about pretty early in the Walker administration, this whole idea of a deer czar. and making some recommendations about Wisconsin's deer hunt.
Right. So all the way back in 2011, the governor brought in a wildlife researcher from outside the state, James Kroll, who came in and looked at how the DNR handles the deer herd here in the state. There was a lot of public input. And he produced a series of recommendations, and the DNR board, the Natural Resources Board, rather, voted to approve many of them. And there will be some notable changes in the way the deer hunt is conducted here in the state in the future. One is one of Kroll's recommendations, which was voted, which was approved, eliminates in-person deer check-in
stations. That's a big change.
Huge change. I mean, you know, the in-person registration.
It's a Wisconsin tradition.
I mean, you know, you go to the bar, you bring, you know, your deer, you brag, or you vent, depending on how the hunt goes. It's a huge tradition here in the state, and under this plan, those will be phased out, and the DNR will in fact require hunters to register via phone or even over the internet.
So why are they making the change? Is it a question of money or what?
Well, I think James Kroll thinks it's a more efficient way to collect data. He certainly thinks the DNR will get some pieces of data quicker than the traditional sort of on paper approach that's happened. And also, there is a monetary savings associated with not doing these in-person registrations. So I think his view is, and the view of the Natural Resources Board, is that this is a more efficient way to gather data about the hunt.
And so, and again, forgive me for not knowing the answer to this. Once the Natural Resources Board has passed on these things, that's it?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to happen. I would say the deer management issue is one that I think is always changing. Mm-hmm. So I don't think this is the end all and be all. But I think we're definitely going to see an elimination of these in-person check-in stations. And one of the other things he recommended was creating these sort of county committees that will recommend local population goals to the DNR. So it'll be up to the counties to sort of tell the DNR how many deer they would like to see harvested in that county. And so, of course, that may change year by year or certainly county by county. And I would say the other thing, too, that this does is it reduces the number of deer management units from something like 134 down to, 72, and those will be based on county boundaries. So the actual management units will also be changed.
Okay, we've only got about a minute left before we have to go, but propane prices, we've been hearing a lot about that this week.
Yeah, the propane prices have really skyrocketed in the last few weeks. We're talking about something on the order of $4 per gallon. In the fall, the average price of propane was $1.65. Again, this week, it's racing towards $4 in some places. Distributors are waiting in line to fill their trucks. So it's a tough situation for people who depend on propane.
And certainly a lot of rural folks around Wisconsin use propane to heat their homes and for a lot of other things as well. Well, Noah, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky.